Hello, hello, and welcome to Art House Garage, the snob-free film podcast where we make art house, indie, classic, and foreign cinema accessible to the masses. I'm your host, Andrew Swetman, and today we've got a discussion of Together Together, the new indie dramedy starring Ed Helms and Patty Harrison. Arkansas filmmaker Molly Wheat joins me for that, and she tells us all about her upcoming film, Uniball. And after that, film history fans rejoice! Classic movie savant Rance Collins is back to kick off a new series we're doing all about Technicolor films. Stick around.
Sorry, I am a little nervous. I've thought a lot more about being a dad than I've thought about making conversation with the person carrying my baby.
Right. Well, I'm nervous too.
To my sperm, to the donor's egg, and to your uterus. Cheers.
Cheers.
Mom, Dad, have some exciting news. I'm pregnant. I mean, the surrogate is pregnant.
I'm not going to tell anybody.
I'm Matt.
I just don't have anyone that I really need to share the news with.
Does that bother you, Matt?
That was a bit of the trailer for the new dramatic indie film, Together Together. The film stars Ed Helms as Matt. He's a 40-something guy who's ready to have kids, even though he's single. He finds a surrogate. Her name is Anna, and she's played by Patty Harrison. And during the course of her surrogate pregnancy, they become really good friends. And the film is a lot about that friendship. The film is currently in theaters and will be available on demand starting tomorrow, May 11th. Here to talk about the film with me is Arkansas filmmaker Molly Wheat. Molly and I met online because she's working on a really fascinating film called Uniball. She's the director of photography and also wearing some other hats, it sounds like. She's going to tell us all about Uniball in just a moment. But it's one that I've been interested in ever since I heard the concept. Molly and I got on Skype recently to have this discussion. And it was actually the first time we've spoken to each other outside of Facebook comments and emails. So I'm thrilled she was able to join the podcast, and I really hope she can come back on the show again sometime. She also has a short film playing in the upcoming Made in Arkansas Film Festival. It's called Uncle Man. So I'm excited to see some of her work as part of that festival in just a few weeks. Here is my discussion with Molly Wheat. Molly Wheat, welcome to the podcast, and how are you?
Hello, I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing very well, yeah. I'm actually, everyone in my family's been a little sick, so I'm over it, but my voice probably sounds just a little funny on the podcast.
So oh, no.
I have some allergies and whatever else going on, but yeah, we're doing good. I'm so excited to have you on the show. So we're going to talk about the new film, Together Together, but before we do that, we're going to talk about your film. So we met on the internet, but I've been aware a little bit of your film for a while now called Uniball. And so I would love to hear from you. What is Uniball? Tell us about the progress so far. Tell us about the project.
Okay, so Uniball is written and it's going to be directed by my friend Ben Eslick. It is the personal account of his experience with testicular cancer. Mm. He had testicular cancer, I think, in 2019, and just like wrote a story about it as a form of catharsis with his fiance, who is also named Molly, which is confusing for us as friends. And
yeah. That's funny.
Yeah, I need, if anyone has a suggestion for a nickname for me, my DMs are open. So yeah, they wrote a story about the experience of what that was like to, you know, sort of find some joy in existing during that really hard time. Yeah. And Ben and I have worked together on some music videos and films in the past. Last summer, we co-directed a 48-hour film, which ended up winning in Little Rock.
Nice.
And I really like working with them. They're two of my best friends in the world. So there's nothing like no greater privilege than to get to work with your best friends.
Yeah. You know? That's awesome. So I became aware of it because I was at an event, the Seed and Spark event in Conway, which was early 2020, which seems crazy now because that was right before the pandemic started, I guess.
We were
in this big group of people. I'm not a filmmaker. It was an event for filmmakers. I just went because I was thought it sounded interesting. Mark Duplass was going to be there. Ended up learning a ton about film distribution, which was so interesting. But there was such a funny moment when Uniball came up kind of in the group discussion and he basically pitched it to Mark Duplass, right? Is that kind of how that went down?
Yeah. So Emily Best, the CEO of Seed and Spark, who was putting on the conference at UCA, she was talking about being able to pitch your movie in like 15 seconds, like the elevator pitch. Mm-hmm. Basically. And she was like, so who here can pitch me something in like one sentence? And I very quickly elbowed Ben. he ended up getting to pitch for everybody. And she came up to him in the break before people were like workshopping things with Mark. And she asked if he was willing to talk about it with Mark. And of course.
Of course. Yeah, that's so cool. I couldn't remember. So that was Emily that asked that question. She's incredible, by the way. Emily Best throwing that event was so interesting and so full of knowledge. Yeah, that was such an interesting experience. So I've kind of been aware of Uniball just on social media and things. And so you guys have like a crowdfunding campaign. What's the latest going on with the movie?
So we just finished our crowdfunding campaign. It ran for about a month, and our original goal was 10,000, and we ended up clearing like about 18,000.
Oh, that's awesome. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's really exciting. And feels really surreal. The whole thing feels surreal, like from the conference till now, because, you know, like meeting Mark Duplass, like, first of all, just in general, a week before lockdown happened, you know.
Seriously.
None of that feels real.
That's wild. So is it in development right now or in production? And like how soon, is there an estimate on, you know, when is this going to be ready for people to watch?
So we're in pre-production now. Okay. And we haven't put out like a casting call or anything yet, but that's going to be the next step. is getting a good cast, and which Molly and Ben will be playing themselves in this. That's
okay. Interesting. Yeah,
fun element of it, because Mark had suggested doing it mockumentary style, and we took that suggestion and ran with it, and so we're hoping that will lend itself to naturalism, and you know, people will be able to attach themselves to like the realness of it.
Yeah, for sure. Well, that sounds great. I can't wait to see that eventually. And I hope that you'll keep us posted and maybe you can come back once down the road when things are coming closer. And I'll try to share out everything I can on social media as you guys are continuing to get this thing made. But I'm so excited to see that eventually and to have you on to talk about it.
Thank you.
Well, all right. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to say I'm excited to be here because I am a fan of the podcast.
That's so kind of you. I still can't believe anyone listens to me. Like, I look at my numbers, but I'm like, a person who actually listens.
Yeah, I think I just Googled like film podcast Arkansas and that's how I found.
That's good to know. I should probably be aware of, you know, how people find me.
Yeah.
So that's really helpful information. Thank you. Well, cool. Well, all right. Without further ado, let's talk about Together.
Hey, sorry.
Hey, man.
Bryce.
So did you guys just do it or?
Matt.
Who is this guy?
You can't do that.
Says who?
Are you like her uncle or something?
No, I'm not her uncle. I'm the father.
Oh, my God. You're her father?
No, I'm not her dad. What do you think?
It is more than fine to have sex when you're pregnant.
But, like, my baby is in there absorbing ejaculate.
I use protection. Why are you doing this alone?
Because I am alone. I'm in this chapter of my life that feels like it should be over, but it's not. It's just on a loop. It's weird to be perceived as hopeless in this moment when I'm actually incredibly hopeful. Why are you alone?
I don't think being alone is a bad thing.
So are you gonna have the baby shower?
I just wanna say thank you for doing this with me, and I also apologize for everyone I know.
Is that what this is like donating an organ?
I don't know, I've never donated an organ before. We should have better boundaries.
are we friends?
Aren't we?
I think that if we are, in order for this to work, we shouldn't be.
All right, let's talk about Together Together. This film tells the story of Matt, played by Ed Helms. He's a 40-something single guy, and he wants to be a father. And the film opens with him interviewing potential surrogates, one of whom is Anna, played by Patty Harrison. So the film tells the story of Anna's surrogate pregnancy and the friendship that grows between Matt and Anna. It's a really funny movie. It looks at pregnancy and friendship and gender expectations and relationship expectations. It's a really very sincere, charming little movie. And I when I first became aware of it, I wanted to see it. And then as I kind of was looking at online discourse, that's how I became aware that you are a fan of Patty Harrison, Molly. So yes. I thought, oh, that's a perfect person to have on the podcast to talk about this. Mm-hmm. So how long have you been following Patty Harrison? What else have you seen her in? And what did you think of her in this?
So I think the first thing that I saw her in was Shrill. Adi Bryant's Hulu show. And I loved her. Loved her. She had, in the first season, it was just like a tiny part, I think. And I just became obsessed with her and started looking at everything she had ever done. She's a comedian first and foremost. Mm. So that led me to watching like her dumb YouTube shows. She had one called Patty Reviews Exotic Animals. I don't know if that still exists anymore, but it was so funny and just like brought me so much joy.
It sounds amazing.
It's so good. She also was like a writer on Big Mouth.
I haven't watched that, but I've heard really good things about it. Yeah.
I have mixed feelings about it, but I respect it. I will say, I think this is her most understated performance. Mm-hmm. It is still funny, but this is like, this is the most that you've seen her pull back and be, you know, sort of real. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Yeah. So I thought she looked kind of familiar, and I looked at her, her IMDb, and I've seen her in A Simple Favor. She's a pretty small role in that. And then, she's in the show Search Party, which I'm a big fan of. And she's a pretty small role in that as well, but I was like, oh, that's why I've seen her face before. But I thought she was really great in this. I've watched some of Shrill, but I think maybe half the first season, and I can't remember. I need to get back to that show, but I'm a fan of that as well. But, I thought she was really, really great in this. She probably the best part of the movie, honestly. I think, her performance kind of grounds everything. She's really, kind of nuanced and specific. It's interesting to hear you say you think this is kind of the most real she's been, because I'm not that familiar with her, and she seems really good at it. Like, it feels really natural in this movie, and she is really nuanced and specific, but also really relatable, I think. Like, she feels like a person you could actually know. I like that. So that the script kind of early on, so their relationship is interesting because it's a legal relationship. Like, she's going to be the surrogate. And so there's automatically like a power dynamic there. But I like that the movie kind of undercuts that right at the beginning. They have a dinner scene. I mean, even in the first interview scene, she kind of is pushing back at him a little bit in ways that, he's kind of surprised by, but I think he ultimately likes that. And it's probably part of why he chose her. But then they have a dinner scene, and he tries to like be controlling about what she's eating, and she just kind of calls him on that and is like, that's not how this is going to go. And immediately, I think, kind of puts them on a little bit more of an even footing. And I really like that the script does that. And I think she handles that really well too. Like, she's really kind of a quiet person. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like the character of Anna, but she's also really strong, I think, and kind of shows that right at the beginning. So yes, I think Patty Harrison is great in this, and I'm definitely going to be keyed into what she's doing going forward, because she makes this movie, I think.
Absolutely. The power dynamic thing that you're talking about is interesting, because it seems like she is very good at just establishing, you know, a boundary right out the gate. And the sort of throughout the whole movie, that's kind of what it's about, is like her figuring out where she wants her boundaries to be with him.
She even uses that word, I think, later on when there's a baby shower scene, and she's deeply uncomfortable there. And she's like, I think we need to have some boundaries after that moment. That's an interesting scene. I think a lot of people who watch this or just see the who've seen the poster and like don't know much about this are going to assume that it's a rom-com and that this is like a romantic situation. I'm curious, did you know before you watched it what the nature of the relationship was, and then how well did the relationship work for you?
I actually had no idea what their relationship was going to be. I read that Patty Harrison was going to be in it, and I was sold. I didn't even watch the trailer going into it. So I was sort of just like going in blind, and yeah, from the poster, you do just assume like they're definitely going to fall in love. Oh yeah. The way that they're looking at each other, they're in love. And it is a love story in a way, but it really subverts the normal like rom-com-y thing of like, you know, I like that they, you know, she is herself throughout, and she doesn't change because of him as far as like what she wants. She is changed as far as like, I think he softens her a little bit. But her personality and her desires and wants and that sort of thing remain unchanged. And you don't get that a lot out of a rom-com.
Yeah, that's really true. I didn't really know what to expect either. I had read like a headline that said, oh, it's a movie about friendship. But I think I got like a third of the movie in and I was like, still thinking, okay, they're probably going to end up together. But then I started thinking, no, I think they're not. And actually, I really like that. And now if they do, I'm going to be mad. I like that they're keeping this where it is, because there are no movies about platonic friendship between men and women. It feels like everything that's got a man and a woman in the lead, it's like, oh, it's got to be romantic. But that's not how life is. And so I think it's really nice to have that in a movie.
There was even one scene where I was like, oh no, they're about to kiss. Oh no. Oh no. and they didn't. They held on the tension for long enough that I was about to be angry. But they didn't give in to it, and I thought that was really nice.
Yes, I completely agree. I think their platonic relationship works really well. I think Ed Helms is really good in this movie. I've always had the sense that he's probably like a much nicer guy than most of the characters he plays. And we get to see that here. Because I mean, like in The Hangover and The Office, he's kind of, not a guy you'd want to be friends with necessarily. Right. But in this, he's like a super nice guy. And I like how it kind of finds some humor in their like generational differences.
Oh,
he's
yes.
20 years older than her. And so that's part of why it would be weird if they were in a relationship. They even talk about like Woody Allen, and she's like, yeah, it's weird. And she kind of changes his mind on that, which is, I love that scene. And that, like, I love that the movie kind of went there and talked about a real life situation, because I thought that kind of made it more relatable somehow. But then they also do things like they watch Friends and she's never seen it. And like, he doesn't really understand the culture of the coffee shop where she works. And like, there's those things, there's kind of some humor found in those things. And just in general, I think this movie leans into like the awkwardness that's going to be there with generational difference, with, again, with the power dynamic or the legal things that are surrounding their relationship, that the script is kind of smart to make that part of the humor of it. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
And then, so here's kind of a personal thing, just, this is actually very personal, but I grew up in a very kind of conservative culture, and I used to work for companies that were very conservative. And there's this thing in conservative culture called the Billy Graham rule. Do you know what that is?
Is it that a man and a woman aren't allowed to be in a room alone together? Yeah.
And I always thought that was so ridiculous, and
just the implications of that are insane.
Yes. So that was definitely on my mind as I was watching this, because like, even at the last company that I worked for, that like, they expected you to follow that rule. I had a really good female friend there. Like, my closest friend in the office was a woman. And, I mean, even I remember like when I've been married for 10 years, when I was like newlywed, I was like, oh, should I be texting my female friends? Like, is this a weird thing? And like, it's just so much BS that was like something deeply ingrained in me. But anyway, so I like that. And it feels relatable, because we have those relationships, and that can be a really healthy thing. And this movie seems to, I guess part of the reason why this feels radical is because you never see it in movies, and it's almost like a same kind of an idea that we can push back against that kind of thing it's like representation in a way. Like, we're going to represent, it's not like racial representation, but it's a relational kind of thing. So anyway, I really like that the movie does that, and it had some personal resonance because of all that. But
yeah, it is a different kind of love, but yeah. I think it like hammers down the point that, like, you know, familial love, friendship love, relationship love, it's all just love. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's beautiful. And yeah, we really don't get to see that on screen. And it's just like not normalized mm-hmm. to us as a culture, whether that's, you know, in conservative spaces or otherwise, you know, we sort of like other those relationships.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny that like conservative culture and like Hollywood are both the places where things must be sexualized.
Like, right.
They don't agree on much, but here we go. And this, they have a similar thing there. Yeah, that's interesting. Well, what else is there anything else you really liked about this or didn't like about this movie?
I love Julio Torres. I'm glad that he was in that movie too. He worked in the coffee shop with Anna.
Yes, yeah.
He's also wonderful. That both of them are sort of from this like I don't know what to call it, like group, that's the best word I can think of,
like
of
a YouTube like, thing or something.
Well, no, it's just like a friend group of,
really
like,
interesting,
of just like you know, New York comedians.
Okay.
That I sort of follow. Nice. He's a writer on SNL.
I just was saying that. I did not know that. I was just clicking on his IMDb. So wow,
he's responsible for things like the, I don't know if you watched the Harry Styles episode, but the Wonder Bread sketch.
Yes. Oh my gosh, yes.
Responsible for that.
Wow. Well, yeah, I need to follow him.
Yeah, I thought he was really brilliant in this. Yeah,
I think he's really funny too. Like, probably some of the biggest laughs. And kind of on that line, I think I like that this movie can kind of balance the some kind of bigger comedic moments. Like, I mean, a lot of the supporting actors are like comedian, and most everyone is, and so there are some kind of broader comedic things in it, but it also has space for these really small kind of intimate dramatic moments, and I think the writing is really strong in those moments too, and I think it's probably, it's like two different tones almost, but they blend together really well, I think, in this movie.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
I wrote down a couple of like my favorite lines. It almost gets to like a like mumblecore indie kind of feeling in some of the scenes. There's a Duplass Brothers connection, maybe. It reminded me of some of their early films. But and I like, so it also kind of gradually reveals the backstories for each of them, and especially Anna's backstory is really interesting. I won't spoil all the details of it, but she has some religious trauma from conservative spaces, and the dialogue about that, I think, just is really well written. There's a line where she says, it seemed like the only way they were going to be happy, talking about her conservative family, was if I was wildly unhappy. And that sort of struck a nerve, like we know those people, like, in our lives, right? So I thought that was really well done. And then he had a line too, where she asked him, like, what's your motivation? Like, why are you doing this alone? And different things, like, why are you parenting, wanting to parent alone? And he had this line about, when I hang out with my settled friends, I feel sad for what I want and don't have. And when I hang out with my single friends, I feel sad for what I have and don't want. And I thought that was just a really kind of nice turn of phrase, and kind of gets at the heart of why someone would want to do this. Cause it is kind of unusual to see someone in this situation, but I think the movie does a lot to bring that up. And then I like too, the genders, there's not a ton of like gender expectation stuff, but there is one scene in particular that I really like that touches on that, where it's a store clerk. She initially assumes that Patty Harrison's character, Anna, is a single mom, and she's kind of sad about it. She's like, oh no, I'm so sorry for you, kind of thing. And mm-hmm. then she's like, they're like, no, he's a single dad, or he's going to be a single dad. And she's like, oh, that's so adorable. And like that whole thing about like, we expect dads to suck, so anytime they're good, it's like, oh great,
let's celebrate.
Wonderful. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So I liked that it brought that scene into, mm-hmm. Do you have any complaints at all about this movie? Any negatives?
No complaints. I also want to mention the scene where they're in the baby store, the like mm-hmm. baby clothes store or whatever, and she runs into one of her sister's friends. That made me want to crawl out of my skin. I have been in situations like that. I felt it so hard in every bit of my bones.
Yes. And at that point, we know the backstory a little bit, and like, she's not told anyone about this pregnancy that she's doing with Matt. And, that scene is so well done too. I was like, holding my breath in that scene. Yeah. That's really, really well done. I think I only had a couple, and really the only negative thing I thought about this is it ends up being kind of short. Like, I guess I liked it so much, I could have dealt with more movie. And I know this is a choice to like jump right into it at the beginning. Like, we don't really have any background. And then at the end, it's pretty abrupt ending too. And I think I feel mixed even saying this out loud, because I know like there's some ambiguity to like, what's their relationship going to be going forward? Is this the end of it? Like, we don't know. I really wanted to know, but I do think it's a strong ending. But that was one thing. But I think some of the editing is like a little abrupt too. Like, my sense was that a lot of these comedic side actors probably like were improvising jokes and stuff, that a lot of which got cut. So then some of these scenes are really short. Like, I think the scene where he's telling his parents about it, it's just very abrupt. It's like a 30-second scene. I was like, oh, I wanted some more jokes out of these two, because the actors that play his parents are both really funny. I've seen on sitcoms and things. And then like Tig Notaro too is their counselor, I guess, counseling them through the process. She has a few comedic moments. I mean, she's pretty straight-laced actually in this. I really like her in anything, but I almost wanted more of her scenes, and it felt like maybe they cut some of that out to keep it kind of moving along. And it does, it moves really quick, and it's like a nice 90-minute movie. I think it's pretty short. Only complaint is I wanted more of it. I thought it was so good, but
that's a fair complaint. That's very fair.
Well, cool. Any other last thoughts about Together before we wrap up?
You know, I loved it. Go see it. I actually went and saw it in the theaters. I went to a 4 p.m. showing, and I was the only person there, which was absolutely heaven. So if you're listening and can work that out for yourself, I highly recommend it.
Yes, this is one of those, like, as movie theaters are opening back up, this is there. And if you're in Arkansas, I know it's playing in Little Rock, at least in a couple of places or one place. It is hitting streaming very soon, too, on May 11th. That's Tuesday, which is the day after this recording comes out. So it will be available very soon to watch at home as well. But yeah, I think it'd be good to see in the theater, because I don't know, sometimes like you don't think of it as a big screen movie, something like this, but it's being really lost in a like a relationship drama like this, I think is good for the experience. Anyway, yes, I recommend it on any size screen you can get it on. That is Together. And that will do it for this conversation. Thank you so much, Molly, for joining the podcast today.
Thanks so much for having me. This was great.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll stay up to date on all the Uniball news as we can on social media and everything. And we will talk to you again before too long.
Sounds great.
Thanks, Molly.
I'd like to start class with a cleansing breath.
Sometimes people just connect. It's not about being attracted to one another.
So how many friends in their 20s do you have?
I don't know.
At some point, you will give birth to a child, and then what happens? Just because you're not, like, together doesn't mean that you haven't created a bond.
But I'm really worried that you're probably making a little straight white guy in there.
That's the whole plan. I'm gonna... Oh, I just gave him a podcast.
If you've listened to any Arthouse Garage episodes about classic films, then you've probably heard my next guest before. His name is Rance Collins. He co-hosts a podcast about Oscars history, a really great podcast, called The Envelope Please, and he knows just everything about classic film. He's back today, and for the next two episodes as well, for a new series we're doing on movies made in Technicolor. What is Technicolor? Why is it a big deal in movie history? Stick around, and Rance is going to tell us all about it. This week, we're looking at the 1938 film, The Adventures of Robin Hood. Welcome back to the podcast, Rance Collins. How's it going?
It is great to be back. It feels like coming home at this point.
Yes. You probably are the most recurring guest I've had, because not only do I have you on for these like classic film series like we're starting today, but you got to be there for the Oscars things, and I had you talking about Mank recently, so yes, you're probably the biggest guest I've ever had. I should do the math on that, but thank you for always being willing to come on the show.
Well, now that you've like put that out there, now I have, I'm going to like find more reasons to come onto the show and so just no like be really competitive. And then yeah. If I see someone like creeping up on me, I'll be like, Andrew, yes. It's time to,
you gotta get back
it's time to have me on the show.
Well, that's yeah. Perfect. I always feel like I'm inconveniencing people by asking them, hey, will you come on my podcast? So yeah, it's good that you're competitive. I'll start publishing my numbers so you can keep up. with the other people. Awesome. Well, we are going to start a new series today. We're going to talk about movies made in Technicolor. But first, before we get into that, I thought we'd talk about what we've been watching lately. And I'm going to go first because you have been watching some Technicolor stuff. So we'll kind of save that for that. But what have I been watching lately? I watched this is not a classic film at all, but it's a brand new film called The Mitchells vs. the Machines on Netflix. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's a animated mm-hmm. thing, but it's very good. It's the same production company that made the Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse animated film a few years back, which, you know,
oh, right.
rave reviews so good. And everything. Yeah. It was so great. So it has a very similar style to that. It's the same production team and it, but it's like a family story, but it's like joke a minute. It's really, really funny. I watched it and then I was like, I gotta watch this again with my kids and my wife. And so we watched it as a family. Very, very good. So I highly recommend that one. And then I watched a handful of things for the Kaleidoscope Festival, which I did a kind of a preview episode on that, which is the LGBTQ+ film festival here in Central Arkansas. And I watched a lot of things with that. I'll just highlight a couple. One that I really thought was great was called A Dog Barking at the Moon. And it's unique because it's a Chinese film, and there's not a ton of films made in mainland China that have, you know, kind of queer themes to them.
That's incredible.
There was a,
I mean, like,
yeah,
that's just a, you don't hear of that. That's incredible.
See, yeah. It feels very progressive for that reason. There was a Q&A with the director, and she talked about how she kind of had to be coy about what she like, because like they have to report everything they're doing to the government, and she kind of like fudged a little bit basically to be able to keep filming there. And it's more of a family drama that like the patriarch, you find out at the beginning his wife catches him with a man, and anyway, it's a very interesting and kind of it's this young woman's relationship with her mother and her father kind of over the years, and it jumps around in time. Really ambitious and really well done. So I'll recommend that one. And then another one that I watched is called Emma, which is just EMA, not like the Emma Bronte sisters film from last year. This movie is called Emma. It stars Mariana Di Girolamo, who is new to me, but she's really great in this. And then Gael Garcia Bernal, who I'm a big fan of and other things. He and his wife are, it's a really challenging subject matter. It's about an adoption issue that kind of tears their family apart, but it's made in this really kind of visually incredible style. She's a dancer, and there's all these incredible dance sequences in the film. So I will recommend it, but it is very heavy. So that was a really good one as well. So yeah, that's just a couple of things, but Kaleidoscope always, so just a couple of years now that I've been tuning in, but really good stuff every year. So highly recommend Kaleidoscope when it comes back around next year. So yeah, that's what I've been watching. What about you, Rance?
Well, first of all, I have to say, I think even though this is not a film, if I'm correct, your family, you and your wife, are watching The West Wing again. Yes, at the moment,
true.
Right?
That's true. We're still, yeah, actually last night we watched, we're in season 4. I meant to tell you about this off mic, but here we are, about that we just saw the debate episode was really great, and then the election night episode. So we're right in the middle of that stuff. So yes, really, really enjoying The West Wing.
Yeah. I just occasionally see a tweet from your wife about The West Wing, and it makes me happy because I love reliving that show. It's such a good show.
Yeah, it's our first time through it, and we're loving it. Go ahead.
Oh, it's just so brilliantly written. I have been preparing for the next episode that I'm recording of my podcast. We're always working a couple weeks ahead of what you see uploaded on the stream. So the most recent episode of The Envelope Please, my Oscar podcast that came out, covered the best films of 1974. And that included the winning film of Godfather Part II. But I have been watching the films of 1976. And so I recently watched all five Best Picture nominees for that year. Network, Taxi Driver, All the President's Men, a movie called Bound for Glory, and the winner, which is Rocky. So if you have any questions about what 1976 was like in film, I can answer them.
Do you always watch all five nominees like that?
I don't always watch all five nominees. The point of the show is specifically to talk about the winner, but we do highlight certain years that we think of as being kind of seminal, if you will.
That's a stacked list there. Incredible.
We thought that the 76 list was just so stacked. Four of the five nominees are in the AFI top 100. You know, we wanted to do a special two-parter episode on that one. So we did that, which we also did for 1967, which has In the Heat of the Night, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, The Graduate, and Bonnie and Clyde amongst the nominees. So another stacked year. And we did it for 1939, which is considered to be like the best year in Hollywood, if you were to ask any film critic. There's an idea for a future.
Yeah, that could be fun. The film series
for you. Yeah. For some reason, 39, and then in more modern history, 99 is those are the years people call out. So I've been doing that after binge watching literally all of the nominees for the Oscars this year. I did a little bit of a movie detox and was more just watching true crime documentaries on and freaking myself out with, you know, stories of John Wayne Gacy and which is a new one on Peacock about him. Which, of course, that's how that got me to get the free trial. I had to watch this documentary. And then I've been watching the Heaven's Gate one on HBO, which is interesting. But last night I sat down for this is Thursday, May 6th was the first night of the TCM Film Festival, which is virtual this year, and next year hopefully we'll be able to do it in person again.
Fingers crossed.
And they have a really great lineup that is both on the channel and on HBO Max. And I watched West Side Story again last night, nice. Which is one of my all-time favorite films. Absolutely love it.
Really Steven quick. Spielberg. Yeah. What do you think about the new one? Go ahead.
I was about to say, Steven Spielberg, you have really big shoes to fill.
Yeah, I've been kind of skeptical, but that trailer that played during something recently looked pretty cool. I was like, wow, this is better than I expected. Anyway, go on.
Yeah, I have absolutely no doubt that Steven Spielberg will be able to make something that is, at the very least, visually stunning. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, the first one is just so groundbreaking, innovative, and on so many levels.
Yeah.
And is such a, and it's such a movie of its time that I don't know if that style can even be done the same way today. Yeah. So it'll be a different movie. So it'll be interesting.
Yeah.
And they didn't just, you know, carbon copy the script or anything. They did update it. And, you know, there's, a character Rita Moreno is going to be playing that doesn't exist. In the original version, it's a converted character from a male to a female, basically. And you do hear her singing in the trailer. She's the one singing somewhere.
I knew she was in something, and I didn't know who she was playing. That's interesting.
Well, the original movie and play has a character named Doc who runs the store that they all hang out at. Mm-hmm. And she runs the store they hang out at. So she's no longer Doc. It's her. So anyway, but last night she and Russ Tamblyn and George Akiris, who are all three in the original film, did a Q&A before the before they played the movie, so it mimicked the way the festival would have a big Q&A that lasts like a half hour, and you're just having a good time, which I know you've been to a few screenings, you know how those go. Oh, so great.
Loved it so much.
It's amazing. There. It was so cool. But then later in the evening, they also played a new restored version of a 1932 movie called Dr. X, which was released by Warner Brothers, just like the movie we'll be talking about today. And this movie was made in an earlier version of Technicolor called Two-Strip Technicolor, okay? And two-strip basically means that whereas the version we'll be talking about has three strips, this one has two strips of film being shot simultaneously, mm-hmm. and then they're brought together to make color. Now, this is not full color in this case. They had basically green and red, but no blues.
Interesting.
So the whole movie, which really worked for this film, which was something of a horror film, like a horror comedy, basically. And so the creepiness really came off because the green was so green, you know. And so having that overdose on one color, which is basically what happens, ends up really benefiting this particular production, which wasn't like a great movie, but it was kind of fun. You know, it was a little hammy, and, you know, they clearly didn't care that much about horror movies being of high quality. But, you know, they had a really great, some good makeup for the kind of scary, creepy dude, and you know, it's fun stuff like that, but and also some really interesting, in the more intense sequences, there was a little bit of that rhythmic cutting that we associate with intense moments in film always now, but must have looked very innovative at the time. But it was directed by Michael Curtiz, who also directed the movie we'll be talking about today. So
there you have it. That's perfect. I'll try to find some screenshots and link those, because just kind of see what that looks like, you know, that two strip versus you know, other Technicolor. But go ahead.
And this movie had a black and white version released simultaneously for theaters who didn't have the capabilities of projecting color. And so most versions of the film that have been seen over the last 90 years have been in black and white. And so they found this really high quality Technicolor print somewhere, and they restored it. And even though I think there have been some versions shown in color of this movie at times, they've always been muddy and washed out and not looking very good. And this is the first time anyone has seen it look like it was supposed to. So well,
that's
pretty
cool. Yeah. And you're hinting at all kinds of things that I want to ask you about with regards to Technicolor. So let's go ahead and get into that. So I've done a little bit of research about Technicolor, but I'm going to kind of pretend like I don't know anything, so you can fill us all in on everything, Rance. But so basically, let's start with the most basic question. What is Technicolor?
What is Technicolor? Well, Technicolor is a, Technicolor, first of all, is a company who makes color film.
That's something I realized. I was like, oh, that's a brand name. I didn't realize that until looking into it. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I kind of like the way we say Kleenex. You know, it's like, you know, it's similar. It's a similar thing where the brand becomes something beyond the brand, if you will.
Yeah, yeah.
And Technicolor existed for years and years and years before they actually came up with a successful version of color film that really took hold in Hollywood, in large part because the earlier versions, as I just talked about, were missing colors from the spectrum, and so they didn't look true to life, and a lot of times they would end up looking stylized or false or weird, you know, and they might be good for a spectacle type moment, but they were not, they were ultimately more distracting than they were complimentary to a production. And there had been other attempts before Technicolor to bring color to film and other types of processes that were attempted. You know, they also used to hand tint frames of film during the silent era when, you know, you only had 15 frames mm-hmm. per second.
Yeah.
They would hand tint frames, including in the movie Wings, the first Best Picture winner, mm-hmm. where they hand tinted frames of the flames of planes exploding, where they drew in the orange of the flames mm-hmm. and stuff.
It's just so in those moments, yeah. I think about like a Voyage to the Moon or some of those, like George Malaya. They always mm-hmm. have those kind of colors
where they have the whole screen
moments. Yeah, or yeah, the whole screen's one color. Yeah.
But Technicolor finally came up with a three-strip process in the early 30s. And the three-strip process had, I believe it's magenta, cyan, and yellow. And the three strips are tinted those colors, and when they are brought together, they create full color, basically.
So it's like three different strips of film overlaid over each other, right?
Mm-hmm. And they're shot on in a huge camera that's doing all three strips of film at the exact same time.
That's very interesting. So that was part of my question too. So it's not like they shot this in black and white and then colored it after the fact. It was actually shot in color. So why does something like Dr. X, you mentioned, like there's a black and white version and a color version. Was that like later, like they converted it to black and white or something so that they could show it in theaters that did not have the Technicolor projectors?
That's it, exactly.
Perfect.
Okay. There was some question, actually. I was reading that they speculated that they might have shot a black and white version simultaneously.
Wow.
But they compared all the frames, and they're the same takes. And so they know that it's just a black and white conversion of the color film. Mm-hmm. So that's basically it. They combine those three strips of film, and you have Technicolor. The first there were shorts that used the process before there were full movies that used the process, and Disney embraced it very, very early and, you know, started producing his short cartoons and then, mm-hmm. of course, Snow White and the Seven Dwarves in the Technicolor process. But the first film to do it was a film called Becky Sharp, which came out in 1935, just a melodrama with an actress named Miriam Hopkins. And that doesn't date very well, but it was successful. Hmm. And then very slowly over the next couple of years, other studios started embracing the technology. And within a couple of years, they had basically perfected it. And Adventures of Robin Hood is the first really big budget Warner Brothers movie to embrace Technicolor. It's not their first Technicolor film, but it's the first one that they really went all out on.
That's perfect. So, I was going to ask you, like, what made you choose this movie? Because I know it's early, but it's not the first. But so you're saying it's kind of the first really big movie that used it. That's interesting.
It could be argued that this is the first movie to really use it in a way that feels natural, if mm-hmm. that makes sense, mm-hmm. because there's a film that came out the year before this called A Star is Born, mm-hmm. Which you're probably familiar with that title.
Yeah.
And A Star is Born, I think that there's not a lot of good prints of it in existence, so it's difficult to judge, but it's a really good movie, but the color coding is a little inconsistent throughout the movie, and a similar problem exists in a really funny screwball comedy that came out in 37 called Nothing Sacred with Carol Lombard, and both of those they look cool, they look good, but it still feels a little primitive. I think Robin Hood is where they really perfect the technology.
Interesting. And so eventually, so I guess it started early 30s, you're saying, early to mid 30s, and it kind of fell out of fashion eventually, because I guess cameras started being able to just film color. But I noticed like the Technicolor company is still in existence. I guess they've kind of focused on, I think some films have had them come in for certain sections and stuff. If they're trying to like emulate older styles, like they'll actually use Technicolor, but yeah, the company still exists, which is interesting.
Yeah. Well, they eventually bridged and they came up with with different color processes, you know, processes. And they were really popular for a really, really long time. They don't do this anymore. But for decades, they would do, they would handle printing the prints of a movie with a process called dye transfer, which helped make colors really, really vibrant on the film. And so they were very popular for that reason for a long time, even if quite a few movies by that point were being shot in cheaper, easier processes that didn't require multiple strips of film.
Interesting. So when I hear the word Technicolor, I always just think of The Wizard of Oz mostly. And so that's kind of the picture I have, is that, you know, it's for musicals and we're going to have these like really deep saturated colors. But as I look at kind of lists of movies made in Technicolor, including today's movie, Robin Hood, not always musicals, and actually lots of different genres. And so next week we're going to look at, or in the next episode, Leave Her to Heaven, which not a musical, correct? I haven't watched it yet.
Not remotely.
So we'll get into that one then. And then I actually chose the third one myself, The Red Shoes, just because I've been wanting to watch that. And so we'll kind of get into that. But yeah, so Robin Hood, I can kind of transition to talking about this movie. It's a really interesting movie. So 1938, it came out. I was trying to, like, you know, imagine I'm going to the movies and I've never seen something in color. Like what this would be like to like experience a movie in color for the first time. And it's this movie, which is like a pretty big, exciting adventure movie. Yeah. So what made you choose this as our first movie to talk about?
Well, first of all, I think it's just a really fun movie. Yeah. It's got, you know, the incredible Errol Flynn, who is like such a personality, such a cool dude on screen. he's also paired with Olivia de Havilland, who's one of my favorite actresses and who is just, you know, luminous in this film.
She's great,
as yeah. Maid Marian, and the two of them together are such a great, they made 8 movies together. Mm-hmm. And I think it's obvious of this reason why they made 8 movies together. Mm-hmm. They have a really great chemistry. You know, Basil Rathbone is such a great villain in this film. You know, the supporting cast is just, I mean, like, Eugene Paulette as, I'm trying to think of, as Friar Tuck, and, Alan Hale Sr. as Little John. Alan Hale Jr. would be the skipper on Gilligan's Island.
Oh, okay.
If he looked familiar, it's because his son.
I noticed he has a small role in It Happened One Night too, which we watched
last
year. So I was like, I know his face, and I found him there.
The annoying guy who sings in the car. Yes. In It Happened One Night. He also played in the silent version of Robin Hood. He played Little John, and then he played him again in a different Robin Hood related film like 15 years later. So he played the same character 3 times in a like 30 year time span. Which is incredible. But Rogues of Sherwood Forest is the name of the other movie that he played Little John in. But I think that, you know, it's maybe the first great movie, like all around great film, to be made in Technicolor. So I chose it because it's not only a great example of the process, I also think it's just a movie that a lot of people will enjoy.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's talk about Errol Flynn, because I knew his name, but I had actually never seen him in anything. I was looking back through. So kind of what's his legacy in Hollywood?
Well, he's a Tasmanian devil. That's the best way to put it. He was from Tasmania, you know, grew up in Australia. And he started making films there, and then he came over here and was almost immediately a star with the movie Captain Blood, also co-starring Olivia de Havilland. That was his first big adventure swashbuckler film. And then he became the swashbuckler star of the 30s and 40s, basically. But he ended up having a very notorious life as well, because he was a hard drinker, a hard partier, a hard womanizer, And he had absolutely no qualms about any of those things. And right before his very early death at only, I believe, 50 years old, he wrote an autobiography called My Wicked, Wicked Ways. And at this point, he had basically, you know, gambled away everything that he had. And his career was pretty flatlining because he looked older than 50 because of how hard he had been living his life. But he's such a rogue in the way he talks in this autobiography. I'm not kidding. It's like required reading, honestly, because it's so roguish and honest. You know, it's a guy in the late 50s is when this is published, you know, just talking without any qualms about, you know, how he lost his virginity as a preteen to some much, much older woman. You know, it's like, and how he considered that his like first conquest. And it's like, what the heck is going on in this book?
Made waves in the 50s. That's wild.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. It most definitely did. But he was known for being a rogue. He was known for like having these constant battles with Jack Warner, head of Warner Brothers, because he was under contract there. He could only be able to film for half the day. He'd be too drunk in the second half of the day. And so Jack Warner started like raiding his dressing room, having random raids, to get the booze out. And you know, one of the staff people would come up to him and say like, Mr. Flynn, we found 5 bottles of gin in your dressing room today. And then he'd say something like, but there were 6.
Oh my gosh.
And he would inject alcohol into oranges. He's a legendary rogue, but he's also by the same point, he backs it up with being a pretty likable screen presence. It's difficult not to enjoy him.
He's incredibly charming in this movie, and this movie, it's funny that they're like the Merry Men, you know, Robin Hood's men. There's a lot of like very boisterous laughter from them in a way that I was like a little bit off-putting at first, but then I was like, I guess that's just part of it. It's they're jolly in a way that's it feels kind of the time. But anyway, he's really great in this, and I am determined to watch more Errol Flynn movies now. And that book sounds fascinating.
They're so fun. They're action movies of their day, basically. Mm-hmm. So, you know.
Yeah.
But yes, he's a legend, for being a rogue, basically, And I should mention that my cat that's running like a crazy person in the background is named after him.
Nice.
Because I named him after, I call him Flynn, but his full name is technically Feral Flynn.
I love that.
Being a feral cat.
Follow Rance for a lot of great cat content Instagram.
Quarantine made me into a cat lady, and I'm happy about it.
Just embrace it.
Yes, but there's also lots of other elements, I should say, even beyond the color, that I think kind of make this into a touchstone movie of its time. I think it also it pairs the color with this musical score that is so wonderful, and it's the first musical score of its kind, because this is the first time that they really took more of a symphonic dramatic score and paired it with what was considered to be a lesser genre, you know. And they elevated the genre and gave it this, you know, kind of classical inspired score by Eric Wolfgang Korngold, who was basically in Hollywood for a few years to escape the Nazis. And because he had been conducting opera in Austria before he came to Hollywood, and he created a lot of the tropes, a lot of the traditions that we see in film music that are still used to this day. And his score for a movie called King's Row, which was a Warner Brothers movie that came out a couple of years after this, was the inspiration for the score from Star Wars. He ended up having that long lasting impact on a genre that can easily be traced back to Robin Hood, because Robin Hood, the way that the famous sword fighting scene at the end of the movie is played out, was also an influence on how the lightsaber.
That totally makes sense. Yeah, it's a great sword fight.
Yes, which, I mean, it is. The sword fight towards the end of this movie, which takes place partially in shadow on the wall, you know, I mean, that's been mimicked and parodied so many times over, but it's so cool and iconic.
Yeah,
and
the way that, they shoot it. That shadow moment is fantastic. I was going to mention that as just like a standout moment of this, but yeah.
Yes. We haven't actually talked about the plot of this movie. We almost, it's Robin Hood. I don't know if you need.
Yes, it's the Robin Hood story, which you are probably familiar with. He starts stealing from the rich to give to the poor. Basically, the king is away for the Crusades. King Richard and his brother, his evil brother John, is in charge, or has kind of taken charge. And he is just stealing, taxing like crazy, and taking what he wants from people, and taking people as slaves and all kinds of stuff. And Robin Hood is the one who kind of sticks up for people. And you know, this movie made a big deal out of, I have not read the original story, I haven't read the book of Robin Hood, but you know, he has some status, and so that's why he's able to kind of, he has some power to do this. I always kind of picture Robin Hood as like a peasant who rises up, but no, he actually was someone who had some status already and used that for good in this situation. I thought that was interesting. And I thought too, the role of Maid Marian in this was interesting. The Robin Hood version that I always think of is the cartoon that I watched as a kid, where everyone's animals, which is such a great version. I love that version. But in that one, Maid Marian, I think, just kind of, you know, sees Robin Hood and joins them. But in this one, there's a lot of time spent on, like, you know, she's very much with the royal family, and is, you know, Robin Hood's a bad guy, kind of is her view. And there's some time taken to, like, he explains, here's why I'm doing this, and here's the impact of what the government's doing right now. And I like that it really took time to do that, and you see she almost has to be converted, and then she's this is a line from The West Wing last night, no zealot like a convert. And so now she's like the most gung-ho to help him out and all of that. So yeah, I like Marion's role in this version of the film. Yeah,
I do too. I mean, and can I just say, Olivia de Havilland was only 22 when this came out. Wow. I was just, I see people's ages, and I realize like how much younger they were when they did things than I am now. And I feel so unaccomplished. Like, Errol Flynn was 29 when this came out. So
this says that she just died in 2020. I did not know that.
Yeah. Olivia de Havilland lived to be, 104.
Wow.
Amazing. And I mean, and you think about the impact. I mean, a lot of people don't know this about Olivia de Havilland, since this is my first opportunity to talk about her. Mm-hmm. Olivia de Havilland on your podcast. Yep. Oh, sorry. That noise in the background was my Flynn, who decided it's...
He knows we're talking about him.
He hears his name, and he's very confused. Olivia de Havilland came to Hollywood right after high school, was going to go to college, but she came down for the summer because she had been doing some summer stock stuff, and she got cast in a production of A Midsummer Night's Dream that was at the Hollywood Bowl. Mm-hmm. And then they decided to take that version and put it on film and make a movie out of that version. And she got cast in the film version based on her performance at the Hollywood Bowl, which she was actually only... she was the second understudy for the role of Hermia And the Gloria Stewart was the actress who had been cast, who was who would later be in Titanic, but was already a movie star at that point in time. And then she couldn't do it because she had a film conflict. And then the understudy got sick, and then Olivia de Havilland went on. And then they cast her in the film version at Warner Brothers. She was put under contract and, only, 18 years old at this point.
19. Wow.
Yeah, was about to go to college, ended up and just said, oh, well, I guess I'll be a film star instead. Then she was under contract with Warner Brothers, got paired with Errol Flynn, ended up basically conniving her way into the role in Gone with the Wind that she would be remembered for. And then after that, she decided that Warner Brothers wasn't doing what they needed to do for her, her career. She was going to leave the studio. But when her contract expired, they said, oh, all those times that you refused to play this part, we suspended you without pay. We've added those months onto the back end of your contract. So you still owe us this many months or however long. And she said, that doesn't sound legal. So she and her lawyer got together and sued Warner Brothers and won, which changed the contract system. And there's now a law in California called the de Havilland Law, which limits contracts to be 7 years and nothing over. Wow. And you can't add anything to the back end of the contract. And Warner Brothers was like, well, and she was in courts for 2 years fighting this. Didn't appear on screen during that time, the mid 40s. And Warner Brothers was basically like, well, you're never going to work in this town again. And then then she won 2 Oscars for Best Actress in a Leading Role. So,
wow, what a legacy. That's amazing.
So, yeah. And then she ended up kind of going into semi-retirement and eventually just didn't, just did a few like TV movies and stuff. And then just spent the whole last 60 years of her life based in Paris.
Wow.
And had a nice flat in Paris and, just lived a happy little life there.
That is so fascinating. That's so interesting.
Yeah.
She's great as Maid Marian. And yeah, I'm going to try to seek out a couple more where she and Errol Flynn are together because they do have an amazing chemistry. And yeah, she's one of the bright spots of this movie for sure.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they have I don't know what it is. Certain people you put together and you're like, okay, yeah, that makes sense. Apparently off screen, there was a mutual interest that neither ever expressed. And so they never actually got together, but they both wanted to get together. Olivia de Havilland tells a story that during the production of Robin Hood in the scene where he visits her, and there's that balcony, balcony, and they kiss. She said that they had to do that take a couple of times in the long shot because, and this is an 80-something-year-old woman at this point telling the story in a documentary. So just, I want you to picture an 80-something-year-old woman saying this part of it. And she says, and they had to reshoot the scene a few times because Errol was showing a little bit in his tights.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh, that is so funny. Oh my gosh, that's hilarious. Wow, that's fascinating. That scene is so great. And that's funny. So speaking of the costumes, that is something I was going to bring up, is that as I was paying attention to the color of this movie, the costumes are kind of the standout thing. I was trying to think, why would they choose this as the project to do, in this big Technicolor way? But the costumes are so bright and vivid. Obviously he's wearing green a lot. All of his men are wearing green. There's some really bright red and other things, primarily in the costuming, I think. But the costumes are, I think, a big part of the visual look of this movie. When I think back to this movie in years to come, I'm just gonna think of the clothing they're wearing and kind of the bright colors there.
Yeah, they definitely didn't hold anything back. And I mean, the scene where they, the arrow, the the arrow competition scene, which has a very famous effect where an arrow was split. And which there's debate about how that was done, just so you know, because, you know, people from the movie will claim to you that there was a sharpshooter who really did it, you know. Wow. And then other people say, oh, no, it was a special effect. They had a wire that went through and I don't know. So, you know, what? Regardless, it's a good scene. But that was filmed a place that actually no longer exists in Pasadena, California, called Busch Gardens. That, you know, has a rich landscape full of color. And then they put up, you know, all these extras holding the flags that all have these colors on them, and the stands where Olivia de Havilland and company are hanging out are all in rich color. And the board with the arrow, you know, is yellow, red. Yeah. You know, it's like that. There's color everywhere in that scene.
It's really in all great. The scenes. It really is I think it's fun all around. There's some great action scenes. Like there's that scene, which I guess is sort of an action scene, but it's just a really fun scene. There's a really cool ambush scene where all the merry men are jumping out of this tree. And like there's some really big kind of set piece things, bigger than I expected for a movie from this time period. So yeah, I think if you're kind of like on the fence about watching older movies, this is a really fun one. And I think even to like I think I could show this to my kids in a couple years, maybe now. I don't know if they'd be interested. I think they would have fun with it. But it's really great, and it has a really satisfying ending too. There's sometimes when I watch an older movie and I think, man, they knew how to end a movie back then. You know, like this just has a great, like, you know, with King Richard coming back, and it all just comes together really nicely. I thought it was a really strong ending to the movie.
It's true. I mean, it's just an all around very satisfying film. I think it also it sets a precedence for how color is used and how these types of movies are. I mean, like how many times have you seen elements of this film in movies that were made over the, you know, ensuing 80 plus years since it was released, including pretty blatant attempts to copy it in the Robin Hood with Kevin Costner and the visual style of the send up of the Kevin Costner version actually looks a lot more like this movie.
I did think about Robin Hood Men in Tights.
Yeah. And then the cartoon does do Maid Marian a little bit differently, but the cartoon story is very inspired from how they handled Robin Hood in this movie, you know. It's a precursor, to be sure, for lots of things to come.
Yeah, and so we talked about the shadows in that final scene, but yeah, the final sword fight is really great, and like the castle set. I don't know if they were really in a castle or what, but it's a really fantastic set, and they're like,
it's a set. It's really, always a wow. set.
It's really
incredible. Well, this is where this movie apparently cost $2 million in 1938. Wow. Which I don't know. It's like, I don't know, like 500 million or something now. That's an exaggeration. It's not 500 million, but it's
a lot of money.
It's a lot of money for that time. They very rarely spend that much money on movies. And think about also the fact that, you know, in this point in time, literally everybody who's in the cast in this movie is under contract at Warner Brothers. So yeah. they're getting paid whether or not they're in the movie, basically, you know? So this isn't like the budget's this big and Errol Flynn got half of it. You know, it's, this is how much money they were putting into this film. And I mean, you can see in every second the money.
I imagine this must have been like an event. You know, we have like certain movies that are like event movies, you know, like whatever, Avengers movie or whatever. But at this time, that must have been like the movie everyone's talking about, you know.
Big yeah, I mean, it was movie. huge hit when it came out. It, you know, one of the top 10 box office movies of the year, and I think Warner Brothers' biggest hit. Oh, and I read something specifically. It was apparently the sixth highest grossing movie of the year, but it was the highest grossing movie in several different states, including Arkansas.
Really? That's fun.
Yeah. So this is the highest grossing movie in your state all those years ago.
There you go. It's got an Arkansas legacy. I wonder, I'm really curious, like, how many theaters in Arkansas had Technicolor ability at that time? I mean, that kind of stuff. I'm sure there's some history books we could dive into to find that out. But
I think by that point they had, you know, it was just a matter of shipping the film out, you know, and projecting it. I think by that point, all that stuff had worked out. Mm-hmm. You know, they worked out incredibly. They worked out. If you look at what a color film looked like just a few years before this came out and this movie, it's really night and day. Like the way that this, you mentioned The Wizard of Oz as well. You know, the way that they use color in those films is, so far beyond where it was just a couple years prior. It's incredible how well they did figuring out that technology.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Well, that is Robin Hood. Do you have any other last thoughts about it?
You know, I have one more tidbit for you.
All right, let's hear it.
One more. If you're a fan of Disney and you like the movie Tangled, the character of Flynn Rider,
oh my gosh,
is inspired by and named after Errol Flynn.
Of course he is. That's so perfect. Oh my gosh, I you know, as a parent, I've seen that movie 1,000 times. I really like that movie, and that makes so much sense. And it also sort of pokes fun at his legacy a little bit, maybe, like his attitude, because Flynn in that movie is the butt of the joke sometimes. Anyway, I'm a fan of Tangled. That is so
Tangled's great. Yeah, Tangled's fantastic.
Well, that is Robin Hood. That is rentable anywhere you can rent movies. And next time we are looking at Leave for Heaven.
It's on HBO Max, isn't it?
It was until today. Literally, I went to watch it this morning. I was like, it's gone. It was on HBO Max, but it's no longer. I don't know if it's temporary because TCM just put a bunch of other stuff for the festival or what, but I ended up just buying it on iTunes. But totally worth the money, and you can rent it for like $3 or something. So yes, that one is available online. Yeah, and I bet it'll stream again before too long, and definitely worth checking out.
They change out what they're streaming. That's all that is.
I'm streaming services, man. Well, next time we're looking at Leave Her to Heaven from 1945. And so this movie is more of a noir. Is that correct?
This is a color noir. Yes.
Interesting. Well, I can't wait to get into that. So when I do a search on justwatch.com, which is where I usually find out where stuff
that's usually
streaming, it is not available anywhere, but if you search it on Google, it's actually on YouTube. So that's it's a funny thing, probably a copyright gray area, but you know, sometimes with older movies,
I see it. It looks like it's in pretty good quality too.
Yeah, it looks pretty good. I think sometimes there's with older movies, if it's harder to get a hold of, I almost wonder if like the studios don't mind it. Oh, I don't know how that all works, but
tell you what this one is. I think this is a Fox title, which means Disney owns
Disney
it now.
Owns it now.
So this is probably slipping through the cracks because Disney doesn't care as much about their Fox library that isn't things that are going to be perfect on Disney Plus.
So maybe this will eventually stream on Disney Plus. But yeah, the YouTube copy looks pretty good. That's probably where I'm going to watch it.
Really, really good. Yeah.
You can buy this movie on Amazon and that kind of stuff, like a physical copy of it. And I'm sure libraries have it and that sort of thing. So it is a little trickier to get a hold of. I imagine it will stream again. Yeah, probably Disney will one day put out all these old things. But so anyway, our podcast will stand the test of time because this movie will be available somewhere. So we will talk about that one next time. I'm excited to watch that and get into it. And all right. Well, I guess that we can kind of wrap up there, Rance. Thank you so much for coming back, and we'll talk to you again next time. And thanks for taking us through this Technicolor journey.
It was a pleasure. I look forward to the next stop.
Yes, yes. As always, I couldn't do these classic film episodes without Rance. Big thanks to him for always making the time to come enlighten us. And big thanks to Molly Wheat for helping out with the discussion on Together Together. Next time, we continue our Technicolor series with Leave Her to Heaven. As Rance and I discussed, that is available currently on YouTube. I'm planning also to discuss a new film from Neon called New Order. That's a new thriller coming to theaters May 21st. It looks really intense and thought-provoking. I haven't seen it yet, but it's about class struggle. It looks a little bit like Parasite, but it's set in Mexico. The trailer looks really frightening, so I'm excited to check that one out. So tune in next time to hear more about New Order. And with that, thank you for listening to Arthouse Garage. We've got a few years worth of episodes now. You can hear all of those in your podcast app of choice. Our theme music is by composer Paul Hunefeld. Learn more at appallingproductions.com. If you want to support Arthouse Garage, leave a rating or review in your podcast app, or you can buy an Arthouse Garage t-shirt at arthousegarage.com/shop. Stay in the loop about Arthouse Garage and the films we're covering by subscribing to our email newsletter by going to arthousegarage.com/subscribe. Or you can email me directly, andrew@arthousegarage.com. And of course, follow on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd. Just search @arthousegarage in all those places, or find links in the show notes. And that will do it for this episode. Thank you again so much for listening. And until next time, keep it snob free.